Boker Tov, Erev Tov, everybody. A pleasure to welcome everybody back to our Moshe's second part of our series of Pshat, Midrash, and Halakha. And we'll find out what day it is. That was last week, and we look forward to this week, the interaction between the different areas of learning and the interaction that sometimes and the tension between them. Vakasha, Dr. Lakshin.
Thank you. Somebody was just saying before, as we were just smoothing, that they've been confused all week because they weren't sure what day it was after the session last week. Well, I'm going to be perhaps confusing you about another issue, another important issue, to looking at the commentary on an issue that we think, you know, we all thought that we knew what a day is, but we all thought what a Jewish day was. And I think that we all think that we know who are our relatives, but that's the question we're looking at today, the question of what is the definition of a relative? And it happens to be in this week's Parsha, the discussion of when a Kohen is allowed to go to a funeral, when he is allowed to make himself tameh, to come in contact with the dead. Perhaps I'll just mention that the very fact that a Kohen is not allowed to come in contact with the dead is a surprising development from a cross-cultural perspective, because in most cultures in the ancient world, one of the jobs of the priest was always to take care of the dead. And the fact that the Kohanim are told that they should be staying away from the dead is a kind of innovation of the Torah. And even when you consider in our Jewish circles today, in cases of death, the people who take care, who conduct the funerals and things like this, are our clergy. And you know, you can the rabbis, you kind of think of the Kohanim back in biblical times in terms of being the clergy. So it's a surprising kind of development that the Torah did not want. The Torah, pardon me for being a little bit sermonic, that the Torah wanted the Kohanim to be associated with life and not to be associated with death. However, this week's Torah portion begins with discussing the exceptions to this rule. The Lord said to Moshe, "Speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, none shall defile himself for any dead person among his kin. V'amarta lehem, lenefesh lo yitama ve'amav." And then we begin with the exceptions. Ki'im, verse 2. Ki'im lishero akarov elav limo ulaviv livno ulavito ulachiv velachoto betula hakarova elav asher lo hayata leish lah yitama. Except for his she'ero, we're going to talk a lot about that word she'ero today. But in the simplest translation, except for the relatives that are closest to him. And who are the relatives who are closest to him? His mother, his father, his son, his daughter, and his brother and his sister, with a limitation on all sisters, but only unmarried sisters. We're not going to go into that complication here. So that's the list. And this list, I'm sure most people here know, this list also is the list of the people for whom a person sits Shiva. It's almost the complete list of the people for whom one sits Shiva. Your mother, your father, your son, your daughter, your brother, or your sister. And then the final verse here, perhaps the most difficult verse in Vayikra, in the Leviticus, to figure out what actually it means. Says in the Hebrew, "Lo yitama ba'al be'amav lehechalo," and so it's not to take a stand right away about what this means. I just kind of left it half in Hebrew there on the English side. Baal be'amav shall not defile himself and so profane himself. Okay, so here's the text saying that priests are not supposed to have anything to do with the dead, but they, except in cases where somebody who is very close to them dies, and the text specifies who the people are who are closest to the priest. But what were we going to do with that last verse there? Lo yitama ba'al be'amav lehechalo. So I've given you here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 translations of this verse into English. The New International Version actually can't decide what it means and offers you two translations, one in the text and one in a footnote. And the first translation is, he must not make himself unclean for people related to him by marriage and so defile himself. So the Baal Be'amav, they interpret to mean people who are related to you by marriage. So you, a Kohen would go to a parent's funeral, but he would not go to the funeral of his wife's parents because they are related to him only by marriage. And they also offer another alternative understanding, or he shall not make himself unclean as a leader among his people. Baal being understood in terms of being a leader. The easy to read version, I had to look this up to see which, there's some Protestant denomination that decided that the English of most Bibles is too difficult to understand. So they came up with an easy to read version that gave an understanding of this verse that I'd never seen before. Were the ones who made it up, but maybe they did. A priest must not make himself unclean if the dead person was only one of his slaves. So the word Baal is interpreted here as a slave owner, and that it says that you go to the funeral of relatives of yours, but you don't go to the funeral of your slaves. Okay. The King James Version says, but he shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people, to profane himself. So Baal Be'amav is just saying, you know, he's a big, important person, and a big, important person shouldn't defile himself. Okay, that's King James Version. The Old Jewish Publication Society from 1917 translation reads, he shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people, to profane himself. That's not all that different from the King James understanding. The New Jewish Publication Society translation, which is the one that I generally considered to be the best translation around, translates here, he shall not defile himself as a kinsman by marriage. So they've come to agree with what we saw here as the first one here, the New International Version translation, and so profane himself. But I'm sure that anybody who understands Hebrew realizes there's another very simple way to understand lo yitama ba'al be'amav lehechalo, and that's what you can find in the Revised Standard Version translation. It says, he shall not defile himself as a husband among his people, and so profane himself. In other words, with the Revised Standard Version translation here, you know, let's go back and look at the texts here. So the texts are saying which funerals he's allowed to go to. And verse 2 says, except for his she'erau that are closest to him, mother, father, son, daughter, brother, sister. And I said that this is, as people who know Jewish law know, this is very close to the list of people for whom a Jew is required to sit Shiva when they die, except that Halacha says that a person sits Shiva for a spouse. A woman sits Shiva if her husband dies, and a man sits Shiva when his wife dies. And in that list there, it doesn't say spouse. And it's possible that verse 4 here is saying, but you shouldn't defile yourself if you are a Kohen, if you are in the position of Baal, if you are in the position of a husband. And that is the Revised Standard Version translation. So there really, when we look at the verses here, we would say that there are two problems here. Verses 2 and 3 don't seem to mention a wife. And verse four, as I said, really difficult to understand what verse four is saying, but verse four could be understood as saying that a Kohen is not allowed to make himself tameh, make himself impure by going to his wife's funeral if his wife predeceases him. So that's the problem, the interpretive problem with the opening words here of this week's Torah portion. The problem is solved in the ancient Midrash Halacha, the Sifra, from the second, third century, where they say, Ki im li she'ero hakarov elav, ein she'ero ela ishto. None shall defile himself for any dead person among his kin, except for she'ero. And she'ero means his wife. In fact, the Hebrew there, I perhaps didn't translate it as strongly as one might consider translating the Hebrew here. The Hebrew, ein she'ero ela ishto, could be understood to mean, and there's no way to understand she'ero except to say that it means his wife. And so if we accept what the Sifra says here, then we look back at the verses here, and the verses say a priest should not defile himself except for she'ero, except for his wife and his mother, father, son, daughter, sister, brother. If we accept this, the Sifra's interpretation, and the Sifra's interpretation is quoted a number of times in the Babylonian Talmud, and it's never disagreed with. No one ever says, no, that's not how to understand the term she'ero. So we now see where the halacha came from. When we look at the biblical verses, we don't understand how we got from that list of six relatives to seven relatives. And then the Sifra comes along and says to us, well, she'ero means his wife, and that's where we have this list of seven relatives. Okay, so that's the interpretive problem presented here, an explanation of where the halacha came from this Midrashic interpretation that she'ero means his wife. Ein she'ero ela ishto, she'ero means his wife. In the laws of mourning, Rambam surprises us and comes up with an unusual kind of understanding. He says here, I'll read it in English. Those of you who wish can follow along in the Hebrew side. These are the relatives for whom a person must mourn according to Torah law. Mother, father, son, daughter, and a fraternal brother or sister. Following rabbinic law, a man must also mourn for his wife. The Torah obligates mourning and sitting Shiva for six relatives. For the seventh relative, the spouse, it is a rabbinic law. I'm sure that all of you are acquainted with the fact that the Talmud is always discussing which laws are from the Torah and which are rabbinic innovations. So does that mean that when Rambam looked back at this line here and said that when the rabbis wrote here, Ein she'ero ela ishto, she'ero means his wife, that they aren't doing interpretation, they're doing like expansion of the text, they're doing legislation, that the rabbis looked at the text here and came to the conclusion there are only six relatives listed here. And then they thought, but wait a second, what's somebody's gonna do when their spouse dies? And then the rabbis legislated. What looks here like interpretation is actually legislation. Is that what Rambam is doing? Well, we'll talk about that. That's the question. When we look at this Rambam here. Is that what Rambam is doing here? And then he goes on, seven of the laws here. See how stringent the mitzvah of mourning is, for the prohibition against ritual impurity is superseded so that a priest can tend to his relatives' burial and mourn for them. We see it, for a Kohen to stay pure, to stay tahor, is extremely important. But you can see how important the mitzvah of mourning is, because we tell the priest who's supposed to avoid becoming tameh, becoming impure, we tell him, when those, you have to mourn for these people, and so you go to their funeral, that's the way to, and you will become tameh by going to that funeral, and that's what you do, and this proves to us how important the Torah thinks the mitzvah of mourning is. And then he quotes our verses, and he continues, this is a positive commandment. If he does not desire to become impure, we force him to become impure against his will. Lo ratza lehitamein metamin oto ba'al korchov. There's some priest who says, I never go to cemeteries. And, so my brother died. Okay, my brother died. I'm very sad that my brother died, but I'd like to remain tahor. But, we pick him up and we move him into the cemetery and deposit him in the cemetery if he says this. And then Rambam says, very surprisingly, Ishto shel kohen mitameila al korcho. Ve'eno mitamela ela midivrei sofrim. A priest has to defile himself if his wife dies. In other words, he has to go to his funeral, even if he says, "I don't want to go to his funeral. I'd like to stay. I'd like to say tahor. I'd like to say pure." And then he says, "The basis for this rule is rabbinic." We'll talk further about that phrase here. Mitamela. That it's the sofrim, it's the rabbis who created this law. Is that what he's saying? Is he saying that this is rabbinic legislation? It seems to be the simplest understanding of this text, that Rambam looks at that line in the Sifra that he knows gets quoted a number of times in the Babylonian Talmud, and he looks at it and he says, they're saying that She'ero means his wife. That's not interpretation. That has to be legislation. This is rabbinic legislation. That's what appears to be happening here. And this made many people, many students of Rambam over the years, very uncomfortable. The suggestion that Rambam is looking at a line that appears in the Sifra and appears in the Babylonian Talmud, and I'm putting words into Rambam's mouth, and you can disagree with me, but it seems as if he's saying, come on, that isn't what She'ero means. That when they say, Ein She'ero Ela Ishto, they don't really mean that that's what the word She'ero means. They're legislating. They've come up with legislation here that says that your relatives must include your wife. How could we say that you go to your brother's funeral and you don't go to your wife's funeral? But this was like rabbinic legislation. That's what it appears that Rambam is saying here in law number 7. It's true that we force a Kohen to go to his wife's funeral, but the reason that we do it is rabbinic, midivrei sofrim. One commentator who was very uncomfortable with what Rambam said here is Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who wrote a commentary, the Kesef Mishnah commentary on Rambam. Again, I'll read this in English. Those of you who can and who are interested can follow along in the Hebrew side here. Should you ask, since Maimonides feels that we derive the list of the relatives for whom we mourn from the laws about which relatives a Kohen attends their funeral, and about attending a funeral, wife is written in the Torah as it is written, Lishayro. From Rabbi Yosef Karo's perspective, It's written in the Torah. V'ishto ketuva ba'oraita l'inyan tumat kohen d'chtiv ki'im l'she'ero ha'karov elav. It's written there. That's what the Sifra said. Ein she'ero ela ishto. How could Rambam say that it's only rabbinic? And so the rule about a kohen attending his wife's funeral, it certainly is Torah law. What's Rambam saying that this is a rabbinic, just medivrei sofrim? So why does Maimonides write that according to Torah law, he doesn't mourn for his wife? Why did he say there, eino mitamela ela medivrei sofrim? So then Rav Yosef Karo tries a really interesting maneuver here, interpretive maneuver here. He writes, perhaps we can answer that Maimonides is consistent with his approach that, I'm sorry, next for that rules that are not entirely explicit in the Torah are categorized as divrei sofrim. A kohen mourning for his wife is not explicit in the Torah, for the word she'ero does not have to be interpreted as his wife. For example, onklos, the old Aramaic translation, did not translate the word as his wife, but translated it as krive, as his relative, which is, you know, it appears to be the pshat that she'ero actually does mean his relative. And Rav Yosef Karo tries to create like a third category. There are things that are Torah law, there are things that are rabbinic law, and there are also things that are d'oraita. They are Torah law, but they're not written all that explicitly in the Torah. Since it doesn't say explicitly in the Torah, wife, all it says is she'ero, and we needed the rabbis to help us understand that she'ero means wife. That when Rambam writes here that eino mitame la ela midivrei sofrim, that the only reason that he goes to his wife's funeral is midivrei sofrim, that Rambam really is kind of saying, because the sofrim were the one who brought out the deep meaning of this text. So Rav Yosef Karo is trying to turn this midrash again into interpretation, into exegesis, that what the rabbis are doing is actually interpreting. But since it's an interpretation that isn't the only possible interpretation, that's why Rambam has this category. So We have this problem, looking at the Rambam and looking at Rabbi Yosef Karo's understanding of the Rambam, we're seeing an excellent example of the tension between the pshat understanding of the text. The pshat understanding of the biblical text is very clearly, none shall defile himself for any dead person among his kin, except for his relatives that are closest to him. And then there's a list of them. And the wife is not there in the list. So that's what the pshat seems to be suggesting. And then along comes the midrash, and it includes his wife there. And then Rambam, if we accept Rabbi Yosef Karo's understanding of Rambam, is trying to have this middle position here where it's in the Torah, but it's not explicit in the Torah. And that's all that Rambam is trying to say. There's been a lot of discussion about this idea of that Rambam's idea that there's a difference between things that are miforash ba-Torah, things that are explicit in the Torah, and things that aren't explicit in the Torah. A scholar at Yeshiva University named Mordechai Cohen, who's written quite a bit about this issue recently, the attempt to understand how does Rambam really understand the status of the pshat, the plain meaning of the biblical text. I'm not going to spend the entire time about Rambam, because Rambam is not a biblical commentator. But other biblical commentators do deal with this. And Rashi just very simply writes, Ki'im l'she'ero. He quotes the Midrash of the Sifra. He writes, Ein she'ero ella ishto. His relative refers only to his wife. And then Rashi amazingly thinks that the word Baal in verse 4 here means husband. Lo yitama Baal de'amav lahechavlo. And Rashi then explains, so this is not Rashi's innovation, you can find this explanation in the Gemara. Lo yitama Baal de'amav lahechavlo. Fasten your seatbelts. This is a really complicated comment here of Rashi. I'll try to make it clear. If you don't understand every detail, it's not terrible. A husband shall not defile himself for a wife who causes his desecration while she is among his people. If the Kohen was married to a wife that he shouldn't have been married to, then the Kohen should not go to her funeral. That's how Rashi understands it. He may not defile himself for his deceased wife who was unfit for him and by whom he was desecrated while she was with him. So that's the meaning, according to Rashi, of that last verse there. Lo yitama ba'al be'amav lehechalo. If he is the husband of somebody who is desecrating him by being married to him, then he can't go to her funeral. But if he is the husband of a wife who he legitimately married, then he will go to his funeral. She'ero means go to your wife's funeral. Baal be'amav says, don't go to your wife's funeral. But that word lehechalo explains that it only means you don't go to your wife's funeral if she's a woman who was desecrating you by being married to you. And then Rashi amazingly writes, and this is the pshat of the verse, v'chein pshuto shel mikra. You know, there's a lot of discussion about what Rashi means when he says pshat, but I very rarely see anybody discussing, using this comment of Rashi to discuss what Rashi means when he says pshat. So let's see what he says is the pshat of the verse. A husband shall not, pardon me if I recite it a little bit like a yeshiva boy, a husband shall not defile himself for his wife while she is among his people. In other words, while she has non-Kohen relatives who can attend to her burial. She is then not under the category of a mate mitzvah, an unattended dead body. And what wife are we dealing with? We are dealing with a wife through whom he becomes desecrated, lehechalo. In other words, because she was unfit to marry him, and he subsequently becomes desecrated from his kahuna. So the pshat, according to Rashi, is you do go to your wife's funeral if you are a Kohen. But you don't go to your wife's funeral if you shouldn't have been married to her in the first place. But if you shouldn't have been married to her in the first place and there's nobody else around to bury her, then you do go. And that is the understanding. That is the pshat of the verse. What in the world does Rashi understand the word pshat to mean? So one of the theories about Rashi understands the word pshat is he just uses it in terms of a contextual explanation that'll work throughout a length of text, that it isn't just looking at one phrase out of context, but you have to come up with an interpretation. And he feels that he's come up with an interpretation of those four verses that begin this week's Torah portion, that can run you through it. And here I've walked you through the various steps, and that constitutes pshat, even if we think that this is very far from the simple meaning of the biblical text. So that's how Rashi deals with this problem, because Rashi generally follows in the rabbinic tradition. He doesn't have any words of doubt as sounded from Rambam, who said, "Eino ela midibrei sofrim," this is only like a rabbinic innovation. Rashi says, no, this is what the verse means. Abraham ibn Ezra, writing a couple of generations after Rashi, writes, I gave you two translations here of the first phrase of Ibn Ezra. I'll just tell you that I was once teaching these texts, and there was another professor who was in the audience as I was teaching the text, and I translated it as, it used to seem to us that the phrase, and my colleague came up to me and said, are you sure that it used to seem to us, that Haya Nireh Lanu means it used to seem to us? Couldn't it also mean it would have seemed to us? A subjunctive. I might have thought this way. It could have been understood this way. And I said to my colleague, oh, I never thought of that. And I said to him, which one do you think is correct? And he said, I don't know. And so since then, whenever I've taught this text, I've taught it with those two possible threads. I don't know if there's a giant difference between them. Either he's saying, I used to understand it this way, that the phrase, except for a close relative, is a general statement followed by a list of details, mother, father, son, daughter, sister, brother. And that the meaning of Baal Be'amav in verse 4 is that a Kohen should not defile himself when his wife dies. That's what either Ibn Ezra is telling us he used to think, or he would have thought had he not read what the rabbis said. But when we saw that the rabbis passed on the tradition that a Kohen does defile himself for his wife, the first interpretation is canceled. So Ibn Ezra is telling us his methodology, which he sticks with pretty carefully, pretty consistently in his Torah commentary. He tells us, okay, if you were interpreting the text on your own without the help of the rabbis, you might very well come to this conclusion that a Kohen goes to the funeral of six relatives. And perhaps we'd also come to the conclusion that we sit Shiva for six relatives. And that verse 4 there says, and Kohen, don't think about going to your wife's funeral. He said, but then, you know, he said, I'm a loyal rabbinic Jew. And since I am a loyal rabbinic Jew, I have canceled out that interpretation. So what does it mean to cancel? You know, this is Abraham Ibn Ezra's cancel culture. He's canceling this interpretation of the biblical verse. So, but what does he think that the words mean? Now that he said this, isn't really possible to think that he thinks that She'ero really means wife, because in other places in his commentary, he makes it extremely clear that the word She'ero could not mean wife. He has this brilliant comment that appears here in the introduction to his second version of his Torah commentary, the Torah commentary usually called Shita Acheret. He writes, Al derech hapshat lo nikraha ha'isha she'er, ki ketuv, ish ish al she'er besaro lo tikravu legalot erva. She'er could not refer to a wife, because there's a verse that says, none of you shall come anywhere near your she'er to uncover nakedness. In other words, we're all in really big trouble if the word she'er means wife. When it says in last week's Torah portion, you should not dare come near your share to uncover uncover nakedness. So it's not that Ibn Ezra really accepts that that's the interpretation, but Ibn Ezra is not willing to tolerate that there be a pshat interpretation that is the opposite of what halakha wants. That if halakha wants you to go to your wife's funeral if you're a kohen, if the halakha wants you to sit shiva for your wife, or wants a woman to sit shiva for her husband, then we just can't interpret the pshat as saying something contradictory to that. That's how Ibn Ezra deals with a problem of this nature. But Rashbam, who is just a few years older than Ibn Ezra, Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, the great champion of the plain meaning of the biblical text. Amazingly, he is willing to live with that kind of tension between the halakha and the pshat. He just tells you that the meaning of the pshat here, Lo yitama ba'al be'amav. He writes, Shum ba'al be'am ha-kohanim lo yitama li'ishto. No husband. The reason he emphasizes no husband from the company of priests, because Rashi said, well, it depends whether you were married to a woman that you should have been married to, or you were married to a woman you shouldn't have been married to. And Rashi says, no, the meaning of the words is no husband from the company of priests shall defile himself by becoming impure through contact with the dead body of his wife. Lahichalo, that means for that would render him unfit for the priesthood. And in case you think that Rashbam is offering this interpretation because he doesn't know what the rabbi said about it, he makes it clear. I know that the rabbi said something very different. The rabbi said, but according to the rabbis, the verse means that he should not defile himself by becoming impure through contact with the dead body of his unfit or disqualified wife, but he may defile himself by becoming impure through contact with the dead body of his legitimate wife. So Rashbam, amazingly, in this very postmodern kind of way, this 12th century postmodernist is willing to tolerate the possibility of two interpretations like this. You know, you can't say that at the same time you're supposed to go to your wife's funeral and you're not supposed to go to your wife's funeral. You know, it's as they say in this country, osha, osha. So you know, it has to be one or the other. It can't be both of them at the same time. And Rashbam feels that it is acceptable to explain the pshat of the verse in a way that goes against that's diametrically opposed to what the rabbis have to say. Some of you will know that this is one of the reasons that I've always been fascinated with Rashbam's commentary. He doesn't explain ever. I've been thinking about this problem for many, many years. Rashbam never explains what does it mean when he says, the pshat says X, and the rabbis say minus X. You know, if he were a rebel against rabbinic Judaism, Mela, we'd be able to understand what he's saying, but he's not a rebel against rabbinic Judaism. He's a staunch traditionalist when it comes to halakha, and he accepts the halakha. You know, there's no doubt that he would tell a Kohen that the Kohen should go to his wife's funeral. There's not a smidgen of doubt on this subject. Okay, so let's back up a second and let's just consider the question here. You know, the pshat that Rashbam offered is really a curious kind of pshat, because it's saying that the Torah says these six people are your relatives, and then it's as if the Torah kind of realizes that I might say to myself, wait a second, I have a spouse also. Isn't my spouse my relative? Is there any logic that could explain the pshat? Well, you know, what might be behind the pshat? You know, again, just repeating, no Jews live a life of pshat, or no rabbinic Jews live a life of pshat. So what could the pshat mean? Around 2,500 years ago, Sophocles wrote a famous play called The Antigone. The Antigone is the story of a woman named Antigone who is a heroine because of her civil disobedience. There was a law passed that her brother, who was considered to be a rebel against the state, may not be buried. And she went, and it was the law was promulgated in such a way that it was clear that if you are hayav mitah, there's the death penalty for anybody who will go and bury Polynices, Antigone's brother. And Antigone gives a number of very moving speeches in this play, in which she says things like, she says to the king, I didn't think that your laws are more important than the laws of the gods. The laws of the gods say that when somebody dies, they're supposed to be buried. And so I'm willing to accept the consequences for my civil disobedience. But in the middle of her beautiful speeches that she gives on the subject, she also gives a very strange speech here. She says, "But now, Polynices, this is my reward." She's talking to her dead brother, who she's just buried. "This is my reward for covering your corpse. However, for wise people, I was right to honor you." And anybody who's smart will say, "Gee, she did the right thing when she buried her brother, even though the king said it was forbidden to bury her brother." And then she goes on with a very strange direction of argument. "I'd never have done that for children of my own, nor not as their mother, nor for a dead husband lying in decay. If I had a child who died and the law was, don't bury that child, I wouldn't have broken the law. If my husband died and there was a law that you weren't allowed to bury him, I wouldn't have buried him. No, not in defiance of the citizens. If the law says that you're not allowed to do it, I would never have done it. What law do I appeal to, Clyde?" This way, what, if you're wondering what the logic of my position is, she says, "If my husband died, there'd be another one. You lose a husband, the husband dies, you can find another husband. And if I were to lose a child of mine, I'd have another one with some other man. But since my mother and father too are hidden away in Hades' house, they're dead already, I'll never have another living brother. That was the law I used to honor you. The relationship here that I have with my brother is so much deeper than the relationship that I have with my husband," is what she's saying. And there were scholars who suggested that this speech should just be removed from the Antigone because it's so, pardon the technical term, it's meshuga. It's crazy to say something like this, that of course I would break the law to bury my brother's body, but I would never break the law to bury my husband's body. But there are other scholars who say that people in the ancient world who heard this would not think that this was so crazy. They would think that maybe the relationship between a brother and a sister is actually closer than the relationship between a husband and a wife. That, you know, there's the possibility of arguing that the pshat here of this text is reflecting an attitude of the ancient world where marriages were sometimes economic kind of unions, and they weren't as the feeling that one had towards a spouse was not as strong as the feeling that one had towards a blood relative. And in fact, you know, we know that, you know, in Shir HaShirim, the lover is referring to the beloved as achoti. Bati legani achoti chala. And, you know, the Revised Standard Version here translates, correctly, literally, "I come to my garden, my sister, my bride." This, the male lover is speaking to the female lover, and he's calling her sister. The Living Bible, another Protestant translation, translates here, "I am here in my garden, my darling, my bride." They're just so troubled in the 20th or 21st century saying that he's calling his lover his sister. They're not comfortable with that. And even the JPS is uncomfortable with that. The Jewish Publication Society translates here, "I have come to my garden, my own, my bride." Achoti means my own. They just think that it's too jarring to write here, my sister. There are even some modern scholars who have claimed, it's hard to get this to actually work in the biblical text, but there are even some modern scholars who claim that the whole wife-sister motif in the book of Genesis is a function of this, that when Abraham called his wife his sister, he was giving her a great compliment. "You aren't just my wife. I consider you to be like a blood relative, and being a blood relative is really... is really the greatest compliment that can be given." So is it possible that that is the shot understanding of the text here at the beginning of this week's parsha that is saying it's the pshat saying that the relatives who are really close to me, for whom I sit shiva, the relatives who are really close to me, if I'm a Kohen, I would go to their funeral, are my blood, my closest blood relatives, and that my spouse is not in that category. Some people might offer that interpretation. But I didn't want to leave us, you know, most of us here are in this Zoom are married, and I did not really want to leave us at this point here of saying that your spouse is not as important to you as your blood relatives. Another great Bible commentator in the generation after Rashbam, who lived in northern France, was Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, and he does what people often do in situations like this, where they see the tension between the pshat understanding of the verse and the midrashic halachic understanding of the verse. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor comes up with a very interesting harmonization to try to prove from the text that which I just said to you right now, the possibility that the text really means that blood relatives are more, are closer to you than a spouse, is going to say, I can prove to you from the text itself that that is not the case. And here's what he says. A rabbi said Sheiro means his wife, and so one can also see at the end of the section, there's a complicated first argument here. I left out this complicated first argument. But then he offers a second argument that's a very interesting argument. He says, also the verse says, he shall make himself unclean for his virgin sister who has no husband. So if she has a husband, her brother does not make himself unclean. The text is saying that the relationship that I have with my sister is a very close relationship until she goes and she gets married. And then I don't have that close relationship with her. He goes on, rather her husband, even if he is a Kohen, he's the one who buries her and he's the one who becomes unclean. That if you see here that the relationship, the Torah is saying that the relationship between a brother and sister is superseded by marriage. And so it makes no sense to say that if that's what the Torah is saying, that marriage supersedes the relationship of a brother and a sister, then it makes no sense to say, the Torah must be saying that like the deep shot of this text, that if you think about the text, it's obviously saying that the relationship that spouses have is deeper. And then he offers what one might consider a strong biblical argument that isn't so much a halachic argument, but from citing a biblical narrative. And so it is written about husbands and wives, they shall become one flesh, v'hayu l'basar echad. And he summarizes, ein kurva Gedola Mizeh. The Torah teaches us that there is no relationship that is closer than the relationship of spouses. That's Rav Yosef Bechor Shor arguing that you have to understand that even the beginning of this week's Torah portion that is listing all of those relatives, it has to be premised on the assumption that the strongest relationship is the relationship between spouses and not the relationship between blood relatives. So you have, I said that I would be confusing you here today about who are your relatives. Is your spouse actually your relative? We've seen many different positions here. We're actually going to continue on this theme next week. I have more to say on this subject, and we'll go on to look at some other problems of these same verses. We'll look at them next week. But in the meantime, you see these, just to sum up, we saw Rambam saying, of course, a husband goes to his wife's funeral, but that's only Midivrei Sofrim. That's not really in the Torah. We saw Rashi saying, Here's the pshat. Here's how I'm going to walk you through the text, and here's how the text says that this is what you do. We saw Ibn Ezra saying, you know, I used to think, or I might have thought that that isn't what the text says, but then the rabbis taught me this. We saw Rashbam was willing to say, okay, the pshat contradicts the the halacha. I'll live with that. And then Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor coming up with this interesting harmonization of the pshat and the halacha. Okay, I will leave it here, and we can open up the chat. And Rabbi Kelman, if you'd like to.
Sure. Can I offer a crazy idea? I just popped in my head. I'm sure it's insane. Maybe the Torah doesn't talk about the wife because ishto kagufo. In other words, it's sort of what you're saying. So there was the chiddush of the Torah. I would have thought, like people said, I don't want to be metamei. It's even a machloka. That's, you know, that we force him is a machloka in the Gemara. You know, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Shmuel says, we don't force him. He doesn't have to be metamei for his parents, only if he wants to be. So it could be the chiddush of the Torah he's allowed to. You don't need a chiddush by the wife. Right. They're exactly one, but it's whatever.
Yes, I have no trouble with that, Rabbi Kelman. And in fact, you know, we have to assume that, you know, when there's you look at the Ten Commandments and it says you're not allowed to do malacha on Shabbat, you're not allowed to do work on Shabbat. Ata uvincha uvitecha v'amatcha v'abdecha v'amatcha v'emtecha v'gercha asher v'sharecha. It doesn't say anything about a spouse, but you have to assume that the assumption is that isho kagufo, that spouses are like one body. And so although Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor there at the end is quoting a narrative passage as opposed to a legal passage, it's a very strong narrative passage that says that husbands and wives are one unit. Yeah.
Rabbi Kelman?
Yes.
I think the example of Antigone's and anything from Greek, you know, literature or Roman, there's such aberration that goes on that it's hard to kind of use those examples, you know, because they only trusted one another, brothers, sisters. There's a lot written in terms of the incestuousness. So that's not the best example.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I see that Epi, even in the middle of the class, said, is this was a relative? See, Breshi 2:24, he sent us to the verse of Bahayula Basar Echad, even before we saw. So very nice, of course, Epi, thinking in the same directions as Yosef Bechor Shor. Somebody asked here, is Rabbi Yosef Karo saying that Divrei Sofrim is a higher category than Derabbanan? Yes, Ellen, that is definitely what Rabbi Yosef Karo is saying, that Divrei Sofrim is not the same thing as saying that something is Midrabbanan, that there are really two categories, Derabbanan and Doraita. And within Doraita, there's two categories of within Doraita, davar sheforash b'Torah, but davar sheinenu meforash b'Torah, things that are explicit in the Torah and things that are not explicit in the Torah.
It's fascinating, actually, that the primary example of Divrei Sofrim in the Rambam is by getting married. That kesef, when you get married and you give your wife a ring, that's your only marry me Divrei Sofrim, and the commentators in Rambam, you know, are don't know what to do with that. The same issue here. In other words, the Rambam says the way we all do it is only meet Divrei Sofrim, because it doesn't say in the Torah you can get married by money, but it's kesef kicha kicha mistei Ephron. So it's kind of interesting. The same thing on marriage, the Rambam also calls Divrei Sofrim over there.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm just going to pick up. I just had something to say about Karen's question here or comment here. She said here, you only say Kaddish for a spouse for a month, as opposed to, you know, the mourning for a parent for 11 months. I remember one time a number of years ago, I went to a wedding and I saw a man at the wedding. He was an old man, probably as old as I am now. You know, and I knew that his wife had recently died, and I went over just to talk with him for a while. And I knew his children better than I knew him. And I said, are your kids here? And he said, no, they're not allowed to come because they're in Avelut. They're in mourning for their mother. And we were just like staring at each other. This guy who had been married for 40 whatever odd years to the same woman, he's there at the wedding, and he's talking about the fact that his children aren't there at the wedding because they're in mourning. And he looked at me, and we were both thinking the same thing, and he said to me, "The law makes a lot of sense because they could forget about the fact that their mother died. I can't forget the fact that my wife died. And so I don't need to be told that, you know, to stay away from weddings as a sign of mourning." So, you know, it was really interesting how he flipped that, which you might actually see that as saying, well, you know, the death of a spouse, you know, you only have rules about Beilut for a month. He flipped it, he said, because of the intensity of it. And so the question is this, I guess ultimately my question in this session was, is this as Epi was trying to argue, and as Rav Yosef Bechor Shor were trying to argue, is this the message of the Torah from the beginning, when the Torah says, "Vayu l'basar echad," they will become one flesh, that a husband and wife will become one flesh? Or is this a historical development as the years went on, and as the nature of the relationship between spouses changed from what it was in the oldest time? So that's the question that people can leave here thinking about.
If I can...
One question. Yeah. I was wondering, you never mentioned divorce, I don't think, unless I missed it.
I did not.
And that is a problem for someone who wonders, well, I could break relations with a wife as if they did not exist.
That is true. There is no way.
I can't do that with any other of the categories of relatives.
Yes, I cannot. That's very true. You're right. That is a difference, that I can't break the relationship with my sister, with my children, with my parents. It's not something I want to do, but I also know that I can't break the relationship that I have with them. But I know in theory that marriage is something that can. So that is another possible argument for the nature of the difference between why the Torah might speak differently about relationships that one has with a blood relative from the way that they speak about relationships that one has with a spouse.
Yeah, but circumstances can break your relationship with your sister.
Yes, it does happen. Sadly, it does happen.
No, I don't mean that. If your sister gets married,
That's true. So that's what Bechor Shor said, that when your sister gets married, she then has somebody, in Bechor Shor's understanding, somebody who's more important in her life than you are, even though you've been around for a lot longer than that Johnny come lately husband who just came along now. Yes.
The question is, of course, the halacha is you sit shiva for a wife who's married. That, you know, where does that piece come from?
Yes, so that's the Rabbanan, although Rambam wrote there that the rules of sitting shiva for a sister are only for a sister from your where you have a shared father, not if you have a shared mother. Again, the custom developed over the years that you also sit shiva for a maternal sister, and so these things are not d'oraita. These aren't Torah law.
Here, as you're reading, I'll read the Kohen does lose his status, right? I see that was if he marries, let's say, a divorcee or somebody he's not allowed to marry. That is correct, right? Let's see. He can't do a vote in the Beit HaMikdash, correct? The Kohen who has a mum, any many defects invalidate a Kohen from working in the temple, and including if he's married to.
But just think about it. It's so interesting. Even though this Kohen married somebody who he shouldn't have married, and now he can't do the things that a Kohen is normally to do, still the halacha says he's not allowed to go to the funeral of that wife, who he shouldn't have been married to, even though we're not allowing him, we haven't been allowing him to perform service in the temple. That's very, very strict. When you think about the implications of the explanation given by Rashi and by the Gemara.
I don't follow Gershon's question about the Ibn Ezra. It explains the word ki nida, ki in connection with incest with a brother wife.
Ki nidahi, in connection with incest with a brother's wife, is because this prohibition is as reversible as the prohibition of nida. Not sure that I understand it either. Gershon, send me an email afterwards and explain to me what you meant, and we can continue discussing this.
Okay. She'ero, Tova points out the end. Zu sheni shara nisua. She'ero zu sheni shara nisua.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you next week, and we look forward to everybody in 14 minutes. Lori Novick begins part two of her series on women in Kriyat HaTorah. Whether that's wife, married, single, I don't think that comes up in that issue. But women in Kriyat HaTorah is an important issue. I'm sure many people saw that yesterday in Efrat. I don't know who Shira Mervis is, I believe that's her name. Is she Israeli or is she American originally? I don't know her. Marty, you know? It's okay. So it's just appointed. I don't know what her official title is, but appointed as the Rosh Kila, the Rav, the Maharat, the Yoetzer, whatever term of a Kila Nefrat is, Rabbi.
So community leader. Yes, the leader of a shul there. And it's the first time in this country that an Orthodox place, a woman is being has been appointed to a position like this, and not beside a man.
Unlike in Benny Lau shul when Carmit.
Yes, so I'm saying not beside it. Yes, correct. That was beside a man. Correct. And here there's correct. Only one leader for the community, and that is Shira Mervis.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, that's not the topic of the Shira 12th, but it's Kriyat HaTorah, but everything's related. Everything,
that's right. Everything
the changing
related.
Status of women, David Weinberg, Dr. Lakshin David Weinberg, who you of course know, sent me an email today, an article. I think it's all very nice, but until women get counter minion, it's about complaining, it's never going to happen. So he asked me what I thought about the article. So I wrote it was in Hebrew, whatever. So the bottom line is you look at whatever words you want to use to change. If anybody would have told you in 1970 that there'd be Orthodox women giving shiurim, talmidei chachamim, to all these things, you would have thought they were crazy. The change has been so enormous and so fast. I don't think, whatever you think of it, it's just a descriptive comment. It's unbelievable the changes that have happened so fast. So, I think sometimes people demand more, just put it in historical perspective. What has happened in one generation is beyond belief. So give it another generation, we'll see what happens. But I understand. Anyways, we'll leave that discussion for another time, the in-between class discussion.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, we'll let you go.
We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank
okay,
you. Thank
well.
You.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, everybody can go get a cup of coffee, and we'll see you in 10 minutes, please, God. All the best. Okay.
Rabbi Kelman.
Yes.
I was trying to find the link to the PowerPoint
I don't have Dr. Lakshmi didn't send his source yet.
I don't have
a source
for today.
For last week, it should be there.
Sessions.
It should be on the program page.
There is recording, but there isn't. When you download, you don't get a link to the PDF. Or to the
PDF program. Should be on the site. If there's a problem, it's there. No, it's not. It's on the site. You have the PDF and the audio and the visual. You should have them all.
Rabbi,
I will try again.
I'm sorry? Yeah. Now, like I said, there were some issues with the site. Some people couldn't log in and see everything, so it could be. But I think that problem is being fixed from what I understand, but maybe not 100%. You let us know, but it should be there.
Is it Lori Novick at 1215?
Yes. Lori Novick. I'm sorry if I didn't mention her name. I thought I did, but yes, it's Lori Novick. She's very good. I recommend.
Thank you for dedicating last Friday's Dvar Torah to my grandson.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. How was the
Several people wrote to me.
Okay. You see, people actually read what I write. Yes, I don't know if they read the Dvar Torah. They read the dedications.
A lot of Mechanchot wrote to me.
Okay, very nice. Very
don't
nice.
Forget that what the woman is doing in that town, it's very specific that it's, Dine Halachot of women. It was very, it specifies that that's her expertise.
Well, yeah, but it's listen, these are all.
It's a leader. It's a leader. Yeah, of course.
Are you live in Israel or in America?
No, I'm in Forest Hills, New York. I'm Rosie Friedman. Right. Yeah, I live in Forest Hills.
What shul do you go to?
Young Israel Forest Hills, and we're also members of KJ and Young Israel of Woodmere, but I live in Forest Hills.
Rabbi Ricky Weiss, right, is your rabbi, right?
Rabbi Ashi Schreier.
So where's Rabbi Ricky Weiss? He's the Forest Hills.
I don't know that person. I don't know that
he's
person.
In Hillcrest. He's in Hillcrest.
Right.
Yeah, sorry, he's in Hillcrest.
Dr. Weiss, you're referring
yeah,
to.
Dr. Yeah, Dr. Weiss. We were in Shear together in NYU. And,
very lovely.
We were in Shear together for 3 years. So wow.
Your program is superb. I mean, everything's so varied. So, you know, lovely, really accessible stuff.
All right, let me take a 2-minute break and we'll see you all soon. And